Well, good evening. Thanks for coming tonight. Tonight, I'm going to tell you a story. And story, or a narrative, to use the fancy term, is the most common type of writing in the Old Testament. Around 40% of the Old Testament is narrative. And most of the time, the narrator just lets the story speak for itself. He doesn't tell us what to think. He sometimes gives us hints. Occasionally, he spells it out very clearly, but usually he just leaves us to think for ourselves. And of course, stories do make us think. They make us ask questions and wonder. One scholar spent 20 years studying the book of Samuel, and he said, at the end of 20 years, I still have as many questions as I did at the beginning, but now they're much better questions. And of course, we know that one of the key ways in which children learn is by asking questions. And if we want to mature and grow in faith, then we need to learn to ask good questions. Because that is a great way of growing and moving forward in faith. The book of Samuel has some very well-known stories. Samuel anointing David, the young shepherd boy, the youngest of the 8 sons of Jesse, is one of them. And of course, David and Goliath, just after that, is one of the best known of all ancient stories. But tonight's section from chapter 4 is not very well known at all. And so let's look at that story together. And as we start, I guess the first thing to notice is an absence. In chapter 1 to 3, which we've looked at for the last couple of weeks, we've seen God raising up Samuel, Hannah's son, to lead Israel. The two sons of Eli, the previous leader, could have taught Sepp Blatter a thing or two about bribery and corruption and the abuse of power, so God rejects them, and he raises up this new leader in Samuel. But quite surprisingly, Samuel completely disappears in chapters 4, 5, and 6. He's never mentioned once. And so we think maybe there are lessons here that Israel needs to learn for itself, questions they need to start to ask. God is not just going to give them the answers on a plate through Samuel. And it's only in chapter 7, many years later, that Samuel begins to speak and perhaps they are ready to hear. Well, chapter 4, which is on page 274, starts with a confrontation with the Philistines. The Philistines were a new people who'd arrived from the sea via Crete on what is now the Gaza Strip. And they had a very well-trained army. They were quite aggressive, and they were always trying to seize more land. And they would be Israel's main enemy for more than 200 years. Eventually, they gave their name to the land of Palestine. Israel, led by Eli's wicked sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are defeated in battle. And in chapter 4, verse 3, they ask themselves a question. Why did the Lord bring defeat upon us today before the Philistines? Now, that's a very good question, but unfortunately, they don't wait for an answer. Instead, immediately they say, let's bring the Ark of God, of the Lord's covenant, from Shiloh, so that it may go with us and save us. I've called this talk Lessons in Archaeology, by the way, which I nicked from one of the commentators, so I don't claim credit for that title. But the ark was a sign of the covenant, of God's commitment to his people. It was a box about 4 foot long containing the Ten Commandments, which of course began with the words, I am the Lord your God. Now, of course, they knew that God didn't live in a box, but this was a visible sign of his presence and his commitment to them. Verse 4, they brought the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim. And when the Ark arrived, Israel raised such a great shout that the earth shook. God, of course, is a great motivational aid, particularly when we think he's on our side. Though the Philistines, too, were able to tap into this source of inspiration. A god has come into the camp, they say, we're in trouble, be strong, be men and fight. I'm reminded of what both Ed Miliband, who's an atheist, and David Cameron, who's an Anglican, said about faith in the last election campaign. It's such a positive force in society, they said. It enriches our lives so much. It's very, very helpful in motivating people to do good. There was very little difference if you looked at the comments between the atheist and the Anglican, which is rather alarming. And there isn't much difference here between what the Israelites say about the Ark and what the Philistines say about the Ark, which is even more alarming. Because, of course, the real God is not a helpful mascot or a motivational aid. He can't just be wheeled out on demand to get us out of trouble. It's a bit like the churches which have the 24-hour prayer meeting. You know, God must respond. It would be so embarrassing for him if he didn't. Well, we usually discover God won't be pushed into our agenda. And sure enough, the Ark does Israel no good. They're defeated. Hophni and Phinehas die, as had been foretold, and the Ark is captured. And there's a poignant scene, which we haven't really got time to look at, where Eli, their father, is told the news, and it's when he hears about the capture of the Ark that he falls over backwards and dies. Phinehas' wife is pregnant, and she goes into labor, and she also dies. But before she does, she gives her new baby the name Ichabod, which is yet to come back into fashion. And I'm still waiting for the first Ichabod, but I think I may wait a long time. And Ichabod means no glory. And she says the glory has departed from Israel. Only now, when it's much too late, do they begin to notice that God has left them. I think that's a little bit like Britain. You know, by the time people realize what they've lost by abandoning God for Tesco on a Sunday morning, it will be much too late. The glory will have long departed. And in all this, there is no word from God via Samuel. Then we get to chapter 5, which is both a tragic and a comic interlude. It lasts 7 months in the land of the Philistines. And they take the ark and put it in the temple of their god Dagon. And maybe it's to show how Dagon has triumphed over Yahweh. Maybe it's because they think an extra god could be useful. You can never have too many gods. But whatever the motivation, the next morning they find Dagon has fallen flat on his face before the ark. They think, well, it's probably just an unfortunate coincidence. So they take Dagon and they prop him back up. And then again the morning after that, there he is again, flat on his face before the ark. And this time his head and his hands have broken off. And verse 6 of chapter 5 says, the Lord's hand was heavy on the people of Ashdod and its vicinity. And we notice the irony, don't we? Dagon has hands, but he's completely helpless and has to be propped up. Yahweh, the God of Israel, has no visible hands. He's an invisible God, and yet unmistakably, it says over and over again, the power of his hand was upon them. As Psalm 115 says, their idols are made by human hands of silver and gold. They have hands but cannot feel, feet but cannot walk. Those who make them will be like them. So it's comic as Dagon keeps toppling over, but it's also tragic because God's hand is very heavy upon them. He is very dangerous to be near. And as it says in the Narnia books, Aslan is not a tame lion. He's not safe. And God's hand upon the people of Ashdod brings devastation. It affects them with tumors or swellings. We don't really know what that is, but it's probably, the commentators say, more likely to be plague than cancer. So the people of Ashdod call together the five rulers of the five cities of Philistia, and they say, let's just move it down the road to Gath, the next town. In those days, there were lots of different gods. They each had little areas of power. So if you just move him out of his powerful area a few miles down the road, it'll be fine. But of course it isn't, and that city is thrown into a great panic, and they say, well, we'll just move it a bit further to Ekron, the third of the five cities. Unsurprisingly, the people of Ekron aren't very happy with that idea. It's going to kill us all, they say, and that's what happens, and the city is filled with panic, and eventually the Philistines begin to grasp reality and say, we've got to get rid of God. We've got to send it back to Israel. And it has been a long 7 months for their land. They're beginning to learn that you don't mess around with the real God, with Yahweh. And maybe the lesson that they're beginning to learn is that very often repeated verse in the Old Testament, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. I sometimes feel like that with some of the people who bring their children to baptism. And they don't bother to come to church beforehand. They think it's a nice social occasion, maybe an insurance policy against something bad happening to their child, maybe a way of keeping granny happy. And they stand up and make these very serious promises of faith. And then they go away again and we never see them. And I feel like saying, do you realize that God is real? That it's just not a good idea to mess around with him and treat him so casually? Do you realize the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom? Well, the Philistines are beginning to realize that. And they make a guilt offering of gold, tumors, and rats, one for each of the five cities. And they put the ark on a cart pulled by two cows who've just had calves. And the two cows have never pulled a cart before. So the natural, very strong instincts of the cows would be to turn back to where the calves are. And the Philistines are all watching to see what will happen, which way will they go. And sure enough, the two cows head straight off towards Israel. And then they know that God is really at work. Dagon couldn't even control his own statue, but Yahweh controls even the cows in the middle of the land of the Philistines. And the rulers follow behind until the cart gets well onto Israelite territory, watching to make sure that it's finally gone. So now we've come on to chapter 6, and the ark is back in Israel. And the people of a town called Beth Shemesh are harvesting their wheat, and when they see the ark coming, they let out cries of joy. They chop up the cart, they set fire to it, they sacrifice the two poor cows as a burnt offering, and they take the ark and they put it on a large rock. And the narrator says, you can still see that rock to this day. This really happened, he's saying. But there's still much for Israel to learn. Despite their much stronger heritage of faith, the people of Beth Shemesh don't seem much wiser than the Philistines in how to handle the ark. Chapter 6, verse 19 says, God struck down 70 of the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked into the ark of the Lord. Just looking into the ark caused so many to die. Back in Exodus, they'd been given very clear instructions. Only the priests can come near. They're not allowed to touch it. They have to carry it on special poles through rings in the edge. But of course, they haven't remembered that. And they're casual about the way they treat the ark. And they pay this great price. The people mourned, it says, because of the heavy blow the Lord had dealt them. And so we see both for Israel and for the Philistines, they have to be very careful about how they approach God. And now at the end of chapter 6, they ask another question, a good question. Who can stand in the presence of this God? Who can stand in the presence of the Lord, this holy God, they say? And the fear of the Lord is indeed the beginning of wisdom. Now it seems they're beginning to engage with the reality of God. He's not just a lucky rabbit's foot, a talisman to bring them victory when they're in trouble. This God is real and dangerous, and you have to handle him very, very carefully. How can they survive in his presence? And if we start asking ourselves questions like that, then we might begin to get somewhere. Anyway, after 70 have died, God's presence is too uncomfortable for the people of Beth Shemesh, so they say to another village up the road called Kiriath Jearim, come and get it. And they take the ark, and wisely they consecrate a priest to guard it and look after it. And then it says in chapter 7, verse 2, it was a long time, 20 years in all, that the ark remained at Kiriath Jearim. And all the people of Israel mourned and sought the Lord. So 20 years it took of just waiting, beginning to think seriously and to fear the Lord. And I guess we know, don't we, that often it's when times of trial and suffering come that we're more likely to start asking those kind of deep questions about God rather than just seeing him as a quick problem solver. Often too, when God is silent, when no word comes, we are forced to think for ourselves. And only after those 20 years of silence does Samuel finally speak. And he says to the whole house of Israel, if you're returning to the Lord, put away the foreign gods, the Baals and the Ashtoreths, and commit yourself to the Lord and serve him only. Well, Baal was the male, and Ashtoreth is the female god in the Canaanite fertility cult. And it was a highly sexual cult. There were lots of naked female figures of Ashtoreth in the shrines. They still turn up today. One commentator says, many people found the combination of liturgy and orgy very appealing. Well, understandable, isn't it? Who wouldn't? But of course, it's directly opposed to everything Israel stood for. And so Samuel says to them, put away the Baals and the Ashtoreths. And it's at that point that the Philistines attack Israel again. But this time, genuinely trusting in God, Israel wins a great victory and the Philistines are routed. And Samuel, it says in chapter 7, verse 12, took a stone and set it up. He named it Ebenezer, which means stone of help. And he said, thus far has the Lord helped us. Thus far has the Lord helped us. And surely he's looking back over this whole story from chapter 4 to chapter 7. During that long time, they'd suffered defeat. Many had died, and there'd been no word for years and years from the Lord. And yet Samuel, as he looks back, says, thus far has the Lord helped us. That is something like genuine faith, really trusting God, not rabbit's foot theology of bring up the ark and we can't lose the battle, but recognizing that even when times are difficult, and even when God appears to be silent, and it seems that nothing is happening, that he is still there. He's still working out his purpose for good. And so that's the story we'll hear chapter 7 read after this. And at the end of chapter 7, for the time being, the crisis is over. Though if you come back next week, we'll find another crisis starts in chapter 8, when the people ask for a king just like all the other nations. And then the narrator tells us the story. He doesn't really tell us what to think. He leaves us to ponder and ask questions. The theologian Jim Packer said that our human fallenness is such that almost every natural opinion we have about God will be wrong. Almost every natural opinion we have about God will be wrong. And both the Philistines and the Israelites get God wrong again and again. In chapter 4, the Israelites think they can wheel him out on demand to get them out of trouble. In chapter 5, the Philistines think they can fit him in easily among all the other things they worship. They won't need to make any drastic changes to include Yahweh with everything else. In chapter 6, the Israelites of Beth Shemesh think that now he's back among his chosen people, he will bless them, and they can be quite casual in the way they treat him. And in every case, they get God wrong. He's not what we expect. He allows himself to be captured by the enemy. He chooses weakness and failure. And in that sense, the capture of the ark points forward to Jesus, doesn't it? Who allows himself to be taken prisoner and even killed in a way that no one expected. So again and again, God is a God of surprises. His presence is highly dangerous to both Israel and to the Philistines. And unless we can find the right way to relate to him, it will lead to death and destruction. In the end, by chapter 7, Yahweh's presence does bring blessing and hope, but only when the people humble themselves and come to him in the way that he commands. And the fear of the Lord, we see, is the beginning of wisdom. So that's this part of the story, and I just encourage you to think about it, reflect on it, and think about the good questions that it encourages us to ask about the God who created us, who created the heavens and the earth, and all that is in them.